Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, April 8th. I'm Maya Trimble.
I'm Jillian Serber.
I'm Willow Moon.
I'm Levi Miner.
We are the Hoopa High School Youth News Team, reporting for KMUD and KIDE.
In tonight's news, Humboldt approves permit for 795-acre Eel River estuary restoration.
Medi-Cal expansion has a ripple effect on IHSS.
And school employees speak out against mass layoffs at U.S. Department of Education.
Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up.
Significant restoration and new public access is afoot for the Cannibal Island area of the Eel River estuary, Daniel Mitz reports.
What's described as a major restoration project in Humboldt County's Eel River Delta area will restore tidal marshes and open public trail access. Restoration of a 795-acre area of the Eel River estuary gained permitting from the county's Planning Commission at its April 3rd meeting. Led by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the complex project includes deepening dikes, replacing failed culverts, and reconnecting 500 acres of former marsh habitat to tidal action. Also included are construction of intertidal lagoons and an earthen levee with two gated culverts to shield agricultural lands from tidal intrusion, and removal of an abandoned two-story structure. About 2,000 cubic yards of sediment will be removed and reused in the construction of the new levee and tidal marsh ridges. A new recreation area with a trail bordering Mosley Slough will also be created. Associate Planner Portia Salcedo described the goals of the project and how it fits in with the surrounding area.
So the primary goal of the Cannibal Island Restoration Project is to restore and expand the natural estuarian functions and processes that promote recovery of the habitat for native fish, invertebrates, wildlife, plant species compatible with surrounding work lands and public access. The proposed project including watershed management, fish and wildlife habitat management, and wetland restoration is consistent with the uses allowed under the Eel River Area Plan and with uses that are allowed in environmentally sensitive habitat areas, or ESHA. The proposed project would not conflict with the Eel River Area Plan because management for watershed and management for fish and wildlife habitat are considered compatible with agricultural operations under the Eel River Area Plan. These impacts of the restoration actions have been determined to be less than significant with the identified mitigation measures implemented.
The project area borders Cannibal Island Road and includes Cannibal Island and the areas surrounding it. The only speaker during a public comment period was neighboring landowner Peter Baer. He questioned whether the project will displace pasture lands and cause flooding.
I am a farmer and a rancher, and I decry the loss of pasture. And I was wondering if Fish and Game had any, could mitigate that by opening up some other ground, say on Cockrobin Island, that they have. The second one would probably be bigger than that, would be the dike that they're proposing along the road will definitely hinder the, when it's flooding, it will definitely hinder the water from reaching the ocean, and it will back up on my land, on my neighbor's property there. That will be I was wondering if they had enough or if they had taken that into consideration, because I've also rescued people from out there on Cockrobin Island in the 95 flood, and it gets pretty deep there.
A CDFW staffer said pasture lands in the project area are not being used and aren't usable due to saltwater intrusion, and pasture lands outside the project area will get more protection from flooding.
The parcels that we're working with neighboring landowners to purchase that are within that project area boundary, the portions of those parcels that we're hoping to acquire and are working towards that with the landowners are also not good quality pasture at the current time because of those tidal issues. And so the sections of the private landowners' parcels that we won't be acquiring will be defending a little bit better with some of those levees. And so we think the actual quality of the pasture in that section of Campbell Island outside of the project area is actually going to improve.
He added that improvement of a section of Cannibal Island Road is also part of the project to accommodate access to the new recreation area. Commissioner Thomas Mulder noted the scale of the planned construction activities and the potential impact of heavy equipment use on Cannibal Island Road. A conditional use permit for the project got unanimous approval with the added condition that Cannibal Island Road be left in as good or better condition than before construction. The project is being done under an $800,000 CDFW grant to the Caltrout Nonprofit Conservation Group. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, Medi-Cal expansion has a ripple effect on in-home services.
California is facing a $6.2 billion budget gap thanks to an ambitious expansion of Medicaid, which in California is known as Medi-Cal. The shortfall comes a year after California decided to provide free health care to all low-income adults in California, regardless of their legal immigration status. Undocumented adults aged 26 to 29 were allowed to apply for Medi-Cal starting January 1st, 2024. The cost turned out to be far more than the state projected, and the expansion is having a ripple effect in Mendocino County. KZYX News interviewed Natasha Adams, Senior Program Manager for In-Home Supportive Services. Adams said there's not enough social workers to process everyone who is seeking in-home care. Adams pegs the expansion in eligibility to the Affordable Care Act, which went into effect a decade ago in 2014. But then, 3 years later, in 2017, the way the state funded the program changed. The problem is that eligibility continued to change, but the way funding was calculated did not.
So in 2017, we had 1,708 cases, and now we have 2,303. This was up as of last month, which is a 34% increase. And that is the continuing caseload. We've also increased with the number of applications to process since 2017. It was 883 annually. And now we have, in 2024, it was 1,125.
Adams explains that the IHSS program relies on a network of social workers who assess needs and authorize services, and care providers who deliver those services. The ultimate goal, she says, is to help community members remain safely and independently at home. She likens IHSS to a big machine involving the legislature, program administrators, social workers, and care providers.
We don't have the adequate staffing, then things start to get backed up on that big machine that's operating. We can't get out there and see people the way we want to, or we can't respond to the needs as fast as we'd like.
IHSS provides a range of services in two categories, domestic and personal.
So domestic and related can range from taking care of household needs, like, you know, making sure the vacuum, mops, clean. Related services is more like making sure a meal is prepared, cleanup of that meal, laundry, grocery shopping. And then we have the personal care categories that can range from help with bathing and grooming and ambulation, transfer assist.
The funding for IHSS is a complex mix of federal, state, and county dollars. While Medi-Cal funds the cost of care hours, counties are struggling with the administrative allocation provided by the state, which hasn't kept pace with the increasing workload. And that's where the recent expansion comes in.
So we're asking that the state provide more of that administrative allocation to provide support for the staffing to administer the program.
The letter she's referring to was sent by Denise Parker, the Director of Social Services, to the chairs of the budget committees for the California State Senate and Assembly on March 25th. Meanwhile, the Democratic leaders in Sacramento are talking about tough choices, and the Republicans are talking about financial mismanagement. For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox. For all our local stories, visit kzyx.org. You can get the KZYX News as a podcast by searching for KZYX News wherever you get your podcasts.
In state news, school employees speak out against mass layoffs at U.S. Department of Education.
Educators are expressing outrage at the mass layoffs of half the U.S. Department of Education workforce. Secretary of Education Linda McMahon says the move reflects the department's commitment to efficiency and accountability. Carl Williams with the American Federation of Teachers represents classified employees in Lawndale. He worries this will lead to cuts in special education funds, and since the kids still need services, districts will have to find the money somewhere.
If we're not getting the funds that we usually would get from the Department of Education, that would leave districts to figure out the funding on their own. And in doing that, it most likely will result in layoffs and a reduction of services for our media students.
Williams says any layoffs could have an outsized effect on classified employees like special education aides, bus drivers, secretaries, custodians, and food service workers. McMahon pledged that the department would continue to deliver on formula funding, student loans, Pell Grants, funding for special needs students, and competitive grant making. Williams says the Trump administration's cost-cutting efforts could really hurt small towns where the school district is often the largest employer.
The Department of Education is a crucial part of educating America's students, and we cannot do this work with less money. My mother would call this cutting off our nose to spite our face.
The layoffs will also eliminate 7 of the 12 regional offices responsible for investigating claims of civil rights violations. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Weekend hands-off protests in SF targets Musk's Doge and Trump policies with call for solidarity. Christina Anastad reports.
Chanting Trump must go, thousands rallied in San Francisco at Civic Center Plaza in protest of the Trump administration's agenda. Many waving creatively worded signs, like one that read, "Scrubbing historical references is no different than burning books. No Nazi, no kings. GOP getting owned by Putin, hands off science. And hands off our rights, our students." Jamae, like most people KPFA spoke with, declined to give her last name. Philip brought his family and children. Tina also declined to give her last name.
I'm here to show up in solidarity with all the people who are being oppressed by the current
administration. I want to come out here and support these people who are fighting to make this country a better place. And we want to make sure that our kids see what's going on and, also join.
How to resist. That numbers matter more than money does.
I'm here to protest the current administration and tell them to keep their hands off of our social services and our rights.
A man going by the name Stark Raving Brad held a sign that read ketamine.gov with an image of billionaire Elon Musk's face behind a pile of white powder.
I like democracy. I like the rule of law. I like separation of powers. I like checks and balances. I like the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. America has a lot of problems, but it doesn't need to have this many.
A group of protesters marched to the Tesla dealership on Van Ness, where activists have been staging weekly actions against Musk, owner of Tesla. They blocked traffic on Van Ness. This protester stood on top of a police car.
We will prove to accept a fascist America!
A fascist America!
Musk has directed the Department of Government Efficiency in firing some 200,000 federal workers in a purported quest to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. Though Tyler Cooper, who waved a sign that said DOGE, destroy oversight, grift enabled, had a lot to say about Musk.
They're not cutting government spending, they're cutting oversight. They're cutting the watchdogs, they're cutting the auditors, they're making it easier for crooks and the oligarchs to take over our government. They're not actually trying to improve anything. They're trying to dismantle our government and sell it to the highest bidder.
Local author Rebecca Solnit was also among the speakers.
The way we get through this is together. That means coalitions, means sticking together with what we have in common, which is opposition to this regime and its attack on human rights, on justice, on truth, on science, on education, on libraries and books, on national parks and nature and forests, on climate and human health, on research, on freedom of thought and expression. If one of us stands up, they can pick that person off. If 10 or 100 or 1,000, they can pick those people off. And they're picking people off, immigrants, dissidents, to make an example of them. But if 10 million people stand up, which might just have happened, they cannot stop us all. We stand up with each other, for each other, and for those who cannot stand up because they are in ICE detention or a nursing home losing its funding or gulags in Guantanamo and El Salvador. We stand up for the people who just lost their AIDS treatments in Africa, those who just lost their jobs in the federal government, for the trans girl who just wants to play baseball, and the educators who just want to teach history, the real history, the true history.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
UC Davis Law students, undergrads, and alumni, alongside CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Monday condemned the UC Davis administration's dissolving of the Law Student Association as the latest crackdown on pro-Palestinian free speech. Rashad Nourzeh from the Council of American-Islamic Relations spoke at the briefing today, condemning the university censorship of students standing for justice in Palestine.
The stakes could not be higher. Right now, we are witnessing a genocide in Gaza, the deliberate killing of over 50,000 innocent people, and the systemic destruction of entire communities. These atrocities demand moral outrage and action from all of us. The students who are speaking out against this genocide are demonstrating profound courage and humanity in the face of global silence and complicity. Silencing them is not just wrong, it is complicity in these crimes against humanity.
UC Davis administration disbanded the LSA, the student government of the school's 600 law students, after it voted to divest funds from Israel in accordance with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS movement. University administrators seized $40,000 in funds of the LSA following its March 24th vote on a constitutional amendment to boycott Israel-connected companies and speakers, declaring that the student body breached university policy. Bill Kislyuk, crisis communications manager for UC Davis, claims that the law student government infringed on the political neutrality of the university. Kislyuk says the LSA knowingly violated University of California policy by implementing a discriminatory resolution intended to boycott people or entities with ties to Israel. Law student Shasun Salur called out the alarming trend of universities capitulating to the nationwide crackdown on free speech.
UC Davis has a duty to protect its students, not punish them for their political advocacy. We're witnessing institutions of higher education fall in line with a fascist agenda that threatens students' lives and their safety. If UC Davis dissolves our student government for its stance on Palestine, what else will they do next?
This comes as the federal government revokes dozens of international students' visas across California and the country. F-1 visas have been revoked for 12 students at UC Davis, at least 8 in UCLA, 6 at UC Berkeley, and 5 at UC San Diego. UC San Diego Chancellor Pradeep said an additional UCSD student was detained at the border, denied entry, and deported back to their home country. In response, UC officials, including UC Davis Chancellor Gary May, put out statements expressing support for the international student community. But despite official university acknowledgement of the fears of deportation the international student community faces from the federal government, student Shasun Salur says that Davis Chancellor May's words ring hollow. Salur says that May's dissolution of the LSA and the Trump administration's targeting of pro-Palestinian activists serve the same purpose, to silence those speaking out against war and arms corporations. Like many top university officials, May has links to the war industry.
Chancellor Gary May sits on the board of Leidos, a tech defense company with contracts in Israel and the U.S. war machine. In 2015 alone, he earned over $280,000 from this role on the board of Leidos. As of February 2024, he holds $1.4 million in Leidos shares. A chancellor profiting from war and genocide cannot claim to defend students supporting a free Palestine. He is actively complicit in our harassment.
In total, the UC system has $32 billion in assets targeted by the divestment movement. For decades, U.S. institutions of higher education have cooperated with the country's defense and aerospace sectors, some of the largest military industries in the world. Critics have long warned of the role of the military-industrial complex in academia, leaving university officials beholden to the interests of arms corporations instead of to their student bodies. One Davis Law student alumni speaker, who asked to remain anonymous, said the struggle for justice is historical and tied to that of apartheid South Africa.
I'm an alumni from class of 86. During our time here at King Hall, we were active in the advocacy for divestment from South Africa. My classmates sat down in the chancellor's office and were arrested. And so this activism is not new, and it's important. We cannot, in good conscience, be associated with the institution that silences the student body in order to actively support genocide in Palestine.
30 UC Davis King Hall Law School alumni signed on to a letter saying they will withdraw all financial support from UC Davis until the LSA is reinstated and allowed to pass its own measures. I'm David Hummel.
Supreme Court Chief Justice blocks court order to return Maryland man mistakenly deported to notorious Salvadoran prison. Eileen Alfandari reports.
A brief order by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts dashed the hopes of Kilmar Abrego Garcia and his family that he would be coming home within hours. Roberts' order indefinitely stayed a lower judge's decision, which had said Abrego Garcia must be returned home by 11:59 p.m. Monday. Roberts asked for further briefing on the issue for Tuesday. There's no indication of when there might be a final ruling on the underlying case. The Justice Department appeal was directed to Roberts because he handles appeals from Maryland. Kilmar Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer Vasquez Sura, a U.S. citizen, spoke on Friday, pleading for her husband's return.
In a blink of an eye, our three children lost their father, and I lost the love of my life.
Kilmar, if you can hear me, I miss you so much, and I'm doing the best to fight for you and our children.
The Trump administration previously acknowledged Abrego Garcia should not have been deported, calling it an administrative error. But the administration also argued the government has no way to get him back, even though it has been coordinating closely with Salvadoran officials to imprison immigrants rounded up in the U.S. Administration officials have also cast him as an MS-13 gang member. They have provided no such evidence. Speaking to reporters Sunday while on a plane, Trump doubled down on the charge against Abrego Garcia.
Somebody said he's a member of MS-13, not Tren de Aragua. He's a member of MS-13, and therefore he should immediately be brought back. Well, MS-13 is just as bad as Tren de Aragua.
Before Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts ruled the Federal Appeals Court in Richmond, Virginia, unanimously denied the administration's request for a stay. The brief opinion from the appeals court said that, quote, there is no question that the government screwed up here. The lower court judge had written that the decision to arrest Abrego Garcia and send him to El Salvador appeared to be wholly lawless, explaining that little to no evidence supported a, quote, vague, uncorroborated allegation that he was once an MS-13 member. His attorney, Lucia Curiel, spoke on Friday.
He should be here right now. Instead, he is in a notorious Salvadoran prison, rife with human rights abuses, cut off from the outside world, cut off from his wife and his children. The government sent him there, knowing it was prohibited from sending him there. They call this an error and are refusing to lift a single finger to bring him back.
Abrego Garcia is a 29-year-old Salvadoran national who has never been charged or convicted of any crime. He has a permit to legally work in the U.S. He is a sheet metal apprentice pursuing a journeyman license. Meantime, after Justice Department lawyer Erez Ruveni conceded in Friday's court hearing that Abrego Garcia was deported in error, Attorney General Pam Bondi retaliated against him. The New York Times reported that Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche suspended Ruveni with pay, cut off access to his work email, and blocked him from performing any duties related to his job. Attorney General Bondi wrote in a statement to the Times that, quote, at my direction, every Department of Justice attorney is required to zealously advocate on behalf of the United States. Bondi added that, quote, any attorney who fails to abide by this direction will face consequences. I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
Israel PM Netanyahu visits White House. Christopher Martinez reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with President Donald Trump Monday in the Prime Minister's second visit since Trump returned to the White House. It's also the first visit by a foreign leader to try to negotiate a trade deal with the U.S. Trump did most of the talking, covering issues ranging from the evils of Joe Biden to the last presidential election, and tariffs, of course. But they also discussed the war in Gaza, and President Trump dangled the idea of another ceasefire.
We are trying very hard to get the hostages out. We're looking at another ceasefire. We'll see what happens. But we want to get the hostages out. The Israeli people want the hostages out. More than anything, they want the hostages out. This man is working very hard with us to do that. I mean, I don't know. I hope he's being appreciated because he's been a great leader.
Prime Minister Netanyahu is facing pressure at home to return to the ceasefire negotiations. As Netanyahu was in Washington, D.C., hundreds of Israelis rallied in Tel Aviv to protest against Netanyahu and his government. Nitzan Shekel was one of the protesters.
I'm here to protect the democracy. We are on the verge from turning from democracy to dictatorship, and I'm here to defend the democracy. My parents came from the Holocaust, and no way I would let Bibi and his gang to change this country from being democracy to dictatorship. This is the message. I'm here. I'm here. I'm going to demonstrate. I'm going to fight as long as we have democracy in Israel. That's my message.
The last time Netanyahu visited, Trump raised his idea of sending Palestinians out of Gaza and turning the territory into what he called the Riviera of the Middle East. Despite the controversy that has generated, Trump has not given up on the idea.
Well, you know how I feel about the Gaza Strip. I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate, and I think it's something that we would be involved in, but, you know, having a peace force like the United States there, controlling and owning the Gaza Strip would be a good thing. Because right now, all it is for years and years, all I hear about is killing and Hamas and problems. And if you take the people, the Palestinians, and move them around to different countries, and you have plenty of countries that will do that, and you really have a freedom zone, you call it the freedom zone, a free zone, a zone where people aren't going to be killed every day. That's a hell of a place.
Prime Minister Netanyahu seemed to agree.
And what is wrong with giving people a choice? Now, we've been talking, including over lunch, about some countries, I won't go into them right now, that are saying You know, if Gazans want to leave, we want to take them in. And I think this is the right thing to do. If you give, you know, it's going to take years to rebuild Gaza. In the meantime, people can have an option. The president has a vision. Countries are responding to that vision. We're working on it. I hope we'll have good news for you.
On other issues, Netanyahu said he wants a quick solution to Trump's tariffs, while Trump hedged on whether or not he'll reconsider the 17% tariff on Israel. Trump says he'll work out tensions between Turkey and Israel, and he said he's opening negotiations with Iran on Saturday on that country's nuclear program. Netanyahu's remark on that, "If it can be done diplomatically, I think that would be a good thing. But whatever happens," he continued, "we must make sure that Iran does not have nuclear weapons." Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer. And thanks to our reporters. Reporting for KMUD and KDE, I'm Jillian Stipper.
I'm Maya Trimble.
I'm Levi Miner.
I'm Willow Moon.
And we are the Hoopa High School Youth News Team.